Thank you. Welcome back. I hope you had a good night, lunch break. Thank you very much. We resume. And I immediately hand over to Advocate Mpofu to continue. Over to you, Advocate Mpofu.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, Honorable Sokoni.
Afternoon.
Right. Okay, I said I asked the Chair to give me the opportunity to wrap up that topic because I wanted us after lunch to come back. Sorry, more specifically to the Venice principles. And just for as a reminder, we've already established that these principles have been received and adopted directly or indirectly at continental level, at international level, and even by the UN. Correct?
That is correct.
And those principles are quite clear in their intention by the heading, page 318. Purple, please.
318, slow table. 318.
Yes. excuse me. We've gone through the reason why they're called the Venice Principles and all that. But I just wanted to say that from the heading, it's quite clear what they are all about. It says on the principles on the protection and promotion of the Ombudsman Institution, otherwise known as the Venice Principles. Let's go to 319. These were adopted in 2019. As at that point, it said the first one is noting that there are presently ombudsman institutions in more than 140 states, at national, regional, or local level, with different competencies. We established that. That's the constituency of Honorable Kajuji. And we say that the recognizing that these institutions have adapted into the legal and political system of the respective states, we've covered that. And then noting that the core principles of the Ombudsman Institution, including, and this is where I'm coming to, independence, which we discussed before lunch, objectivity, transparency, fairness, and impartiality may be achieved through a variety of different models. So I suppose by that we are to understand that those are the core principles, but it doesn't mean every country under the sun must have the same system, for as long as they respect the core principles.
Correct.
Right. Let's just go to the last one. Expressing serious concern with the fact that the Ombudsman Institution is at times under different forms of attacks and threats, such as physical or mental coercion, legal actions, threatening immunity, suppression, reprisal, budgetary cuts and limitation of its mandate. Again, some of those issues we have not covered, such as the physical and mental coercion, although it applies here. We'll deal with it when the public protector is testifying. But I'm more interested in the in what they call suppression reprisal. What does that refer to?
When they refer to suppression reprisal, they're referring to acts of reprisals against the office of the ombudsman, therefore resulting in suppressing most of the powers of the public protector and even the principals, and that on which the office of the ombudsman is based on.
Right. And also very quickly, something that we have covered, please go to page 320, right at the bottom, Safa. Again, if you want to comment, you can comment, but I think we covered some of this. It says the ombudsman institution shall be given an appropriately high rank, also reflected in the remuneration of the ombudsman and in the retirement compensation. Why is that important?
Of course, what they are talking about is ensuring that the ombudsman is untouchable, cannot be corrupted. The conditions of service must be sufficiently high, especially if they are equated to that of a judge. This is the reason why we protect our judiciary.
Wow.
The terms and conditions of service are sufficiently high in order to discourage any official of the judiciary from being enticed to receive any sort of bribes or anything.
And incidentally, why we're talking about the judiciary, bearing in mind the discussion we had this morning, which I won't revisit, about what, let's call it, parity of treatment. Is it in accordance with that principle? Or no, let me ask it differently. Have you ever heard of a situation where a judge, let's say, gives a completely outrageous judgment and gets scathing remarks from the appellate court about it, which happens all the time, and then that judge is then called to parliament for impeachment just because they had a bad judgment against them? Would that be consistent with the system of protecting the independence of the judiciary?
Normally, in such a situation, the defendant, I mean, be it whether it's the plaintiff, would be in a position to appeal the judgment. There would be, I think there hasn't been any situation where the judge has to answer because his answer to any authority because his decision has been appealed against.
Yes. All right. And paragraph 10 about the minimum term of 7 years, we already went through that. Oh, no, we didn't. I'll just read it out. I don't need you to comment, you can just confirm. So the term of office shall be no longer than the mandate of the appointing body. The term of office shall preferably be limited to a single term with no option for re-election. At any rate, the ombudsman mandate shall be renewable only once. The single term shall preferably not be stipulated below 7 years. So they're saying preferably non-renewable, but if it's renewable, it must only be once, and the minimum of 7 years. We've already confirmed that.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. And what I really want from you are the underlying principles. So it's not like somebody just woke up and said, well, these people must serve only for 7 years or they must not non-renewable. It is to serve a particular purpose. What is that apropos independence of the institution? Why is it important? What would happen if these people could have renewable terms, 6 or 7 renewable terms? How could that be a threat to their independence?
The proviso which states that the term of office should be non-renewable is to prevent any arm of government trying to negotiate with the ombudsman that, no, if you take an investigation in this particular way, then we'll give you another term of office. So there should be no reason for the ombudsman, for the ombudsman's term of office to be disturbed, and there should be no reason for the ombudsman to be enticed or to get attracted to compromising his position simply because he wants his term to be renewed.
Good. Thank you. And because isn't it human nature being what it is, if my term was renewable, then let's say it's a 7-year term. On the 6th year, am I likely to make findings against the people who are going to be considering whether I should stay or go?
Yes, exactly. That is the reason why I said that to avoid the ombudsman being compromised, this is just human nature, you know?
And doesn't it also apply to our previous example? If I know that this person has the power to suspend me, for example, willy-nilly, and if I'm a calculating public protector, then I will avoid even investigating them, or let alone to ask them 31 questions.
So the office of the ombudsman should be above reproach. It should be beyond the reach of any person.
Yeah.
This is the reason why the provisions and the protections you see in these international instruments have been couched in such a way that the office is really cemented and entrenched, you know, under all the protective principles.
Yes. Principle 11, and again, I'll ask for a comment like that as to the underlying rationale, as you understand it. So the ombudsman shall be removed from office only according to an exhaustive list of clear and reasonable conditions established by law. This shall relate solely to the essential criteria of incapacity, inability to perform the functions of office, misbehavior or misconduct, which shall be narrowly interpreted. And I want to emphasize that last part. In other words, misconduct could be anything from, you know, stealing an apple or coming to work late or whatever. So what is the purpose that would say that it must be solely, it's quite restrictive. Solely relates to this and that and the other, and those must be narrowly interpreted.
Yeah.
What would be wrong with interpreting them widely as in the normal course?
So interpreting any of these provisions like incapacity, inability to perform the functions of office or misbehavior, interpreting them too broadly means that you're actually encouraging people who are either shopping for the job or shopping to have an incumbent removed from office for personal reasons. It's just to discourage petty reasons being used to remove an incumbent from office.
Yeah. And would that also apply to people who have, who are campaigning for the removal of the public protector sometimes even before she starts? We just don't like her for some reason or another. If those terms are not narrowly interpreted, wouldn't it open her to that kind of abuse by, for example, an individual or a political party that has a vendetta?
Yes, definitely. And it has happened before on to many an ombudsman. I think myself included. So these things are real.
Yes. Hence the need for the protections.
Yes.
By the way, let me finish that sentence. The parliamentary majority required for removal by parliament itself or by a court on request of parliament shall be equal to and preferably higher than the one required for election. I think if we escape being expelled, it will be because of that one. At least there we qualify, because there were the requirement for selection is 60%, but it's 67.6, or let's say 67% for removal. So that's a good thing, right?
Yes, it's in line with the provisions.
Yeah.
Of any
in fact, you may or may not know this. In our South African sense, were helped by the Constitutional Court. The original constitution prescribed a simple majority, and the Constitutional Court, in a case known as the certification case, said no, for the public protector in particular and the auditor general, this should be a two-thirds majority for obvious reasons, protection.
Yes. That is correct.
Okay. And then here's the big one. The procedure for removal shall be public, transparent, provided for by law, and elsewhere it also says it must be fair. That should go without saying, correct?
That is correct.
And what should happen if the procedure is found to be unfair in one way or another? I'll make an example, quote unquote example. In the process, the public protector is denied legal representation, and the procedure just continues without any legal representation. From the face of it, would that be fair?
No, it would not be fair.
Oh. All right. And again, let's make another example. Let's say that one of the people who are supposed to judge the public protector or to remove her is married to the complainant. Would that be fair?
I beg your pardon?
Let's say one of the people, let's say there's a panel of 5 or 10 people or 20 or 30, but one of them is married to the complainant. Would that be fair?
That would be completely unfair. It's a conflict of interest which should be addressed.
Okay. Thank you. Anyway, yeah. By the way, I wanted to talk to you about was yours presents an interesting example, because this issue of political interference, as you're saying, is real. But it looks like some countries are able to handle it better than others. And on that scale, I would say our country is on a scale of 0 to 10 is on 0. But your country seems like it is maybe on 9. How many presidents have you gone through as a public protector and you're still sitting there?
5 presidents.
Wow. Okay. And how many political parties do they represent? Were they all from the same political party?
No, that's 3 political parties, 3 different political parties.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think I'm going to move to Zambia. You can't even handle factions within the same political party. But anyway, and in those years, I'm sure you've had challenges, but nobody dared because there were changes of government or changes of political parties to think that they should bring you to something like this, let's say for some HR issues, correct?
Correct. There has been no proceedings against them.
Oh. Well, yeah. That's why your country is an older democracy than ours.
Anyway, I must state that the institution of the Ombudsman in Zambia was established in the 1973 constitution. So the office was opened in 1974.
Wow.
So it's quite an old office. I think there's been time for them to actually learn more about ombudsmanship.
Yeah, well, I suppose you can take your horse to the water. So we will learn if we're willing to learn. Okay. The last one on 321, the competence of the ombudsman relating to the judiciary shall be confined to ensuring procedural efficiency and administrative functioning of that system. Okay, this is another typical checks and balances mechanism, isn't it? And it's misunderstood, by the way, I'm sure even in other situations. People think that the public protector is prohibited from investigating the judiciary, but that's actually not true. The constitution only says that. Okay, I'm just trying to find the sections. Yes, it's 182.3. The public protector may not investigate court decisions, which is a different thing from saying you may not investigate the judiciary. In other words, the public protector can say, or rather, if I'm an aggrieved litigant who's lost the case or whatever, or is about to be evicted or whatever, I can take that decision to the public protector and say this judge made a mistake. But what is the situation when it comes to administrative decisions of, let's say, the Chief Justice's office or that kind of thing?
Normally, if I take the example of Zambia, the constitutional functions of the courts are restricted to the judges. And then, of course, the administrative functions, there is usually a chief executive officer. So the judiciary may be investigated in its administrative functions, but not in its constitutional functions.
Yes.
But I will vary that a little bit to say that was the position in our previous constitution. But in the current constitution, when we have become a parliamentary ombudsman, there are specific provisions stating that the ombudsman shall not investigate either the judiciary or the legislature. So we investigate exclusively the executive. But in a lot of jurisdictions in Europe where they have the classic ombudsman system, the ombudspersons do investigate the judiciary in its administrative functions.
Yeah.
Some even review the decisions. But
yes.
I don't know how they do that, how they do things.
Yes, thank you. So, okay, so at least I'm happy now. So at least in that respect, we are better than Zambia.
Yes.
Okay. And in fact, an example in this country had to do with this matter, where there was some gentleman who heard it on, quote, good authority that there was going to be a judgment against the public protector. And in this matter, and then the public protector was able to, or rather, to do an investigation. I mean, in the end, it was overruled by the same judiciary. But at the very least, nobody said that she could not investigate the administrative side of the judiciary. In other words, whether the judgment was leaked deliberately or not. So that's a good one. That's a tick for us, correct?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Right. Now, if we go to 322. To 16, the ombudsman shall have discretionary power on his or her own initiative or as a result of a complaint to investigate cases in which due regard to available administrative remedies. The ombudsman shall be entitled to request the cooperation of any individual or organization may be able to assist his or her investigation. The ombudsman shall have a legally enforceable right to unrestricted access to all relevant documents, databases, and materials, including those which might otherwise be legally privileged or confidential. This includes the right to unhindered access to buildings, institutions, and persons, including those deprived of their liberty. Okay, in this country, I think we are 50% there, because the first part, own initiative investigations are allowed in terms of Section 6 of our Act. But there's a case which found that the public protector could not subpoena documents from SARS, for example. And it's a case that you and I will discuss later or tomorrow morning. Are you familiar with the case of public protector versus commissioner for SARS?
I think I have had occasion to read it.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, we'll deal with it in a different context. But if you care to comment on just this aspect of what you think of that case insofar as it seems to suggest that the public protector should not have access to SARS documents.
The provision in the Venice Principles and in almost any other instrument that covers the issue of the ombudsman's right to have access to documents does not give actually any exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a little bit surprised that there was a need for the matter to go as far as it did in this particular matter.
Mm-hmm.
But I also noted that the court on appeal, what was the constitutional court, stated that there could have been other ways in which the public protector could have accessed the particular records that she wanted to access. But I merely noted that the person, the owner of those records was actually not, I think, a party to the proceedings, was not a public official. So there are certain rules when we are carrying out investigations. We don't go to private entities to get information or to private persons. It's actually supposed to be the state entity that is supposed to give us the information that we need. And in the interest of justice, it should actually not be difficult for the ombudsman to access those documents from a state entity.
Okay.
It should not be made difficult.
No, thank you. Okay, I get that case. So my view is probably subjective. So I'm glad to hear that you agree with what we said there. Yes, no, that's true. The public protector wanted access to documents of a certain former president in that case. All right. Then the next point deal with, in our domestic situation, what I call the 31 questions that the public protector asked from the president. It says the ombudsman shall have the power to interview or demand written explanations of officials and authorities and shall furthermore give particular attention to and protection to whistleblowers within the public sector. Goes without saying, correct?
Correct.
Next one, the ombudsman shall have the power to address individual recommendations to anybody or institutions with the competency of the institution. Ombudsman shall have legally enforceable right to demand that officials and authorities respond within a reasonable time set by the ombudsman. And in the our example, I think she had given the president 30 days, but well, it's almost 9 months now, but and we're still waiting. But why do the principals insist, or at least prescribe, that the ombudsman should give a reasonable period? Let's say maybe 30 days was too harsh. 3 months, 6 months, but obviously not like a year or 9 months.
Basically, that is, we use the instrument, the tool that is available to us, the order or partum rule, that we should give all parties enough time to prepare their case before the ombudsman. So it is up to up to the ombudsman. Sometimes it will be a statutory requirement that you give a certain party 30 days, but it's up to the ombudsman's discretion to even exceed a limit, a time limit which has been set by statute. But the most important point here is that there should be procedural fairness. You should allow each party enough time to put together their evidence before they present it to the public protector.
Good. Thank you. And the next one relates to a very important topic for this particular, the charges that the public protector faces here. Maybe I should preface it by this. You would agree as a lawyer that the Constitution, I think there's a court case, I've forgotten the name. The Constitution is just a piece of legislation. It's Act 108 of 1996, I think. So it's like any other act, except, of course, that it's the Constitution. It's a superior type of legislation, but it's legislation, correct?
Yes, it is legislation, not the supreme law of the land.
Yeah. Yes. In fact, yeah, it's even better to put it like that. Yeah, it's law. and it just happens to be the supreme law. Just as legislation is law, the common law is law.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying that because maybe for you and I as lawyers, that might seem so basic, but sometimes it's not that simple. Now, one of the charges here relates to something about the public protector having proposed a constitutional amendment. And this annoyed, shall we say, big capital. In this case, it was a particular bank, and all hell broke loose. How could she even think of suggesting a constitutional amendment? Is that such a sacrilege? I mean, if the public protector felt that there was something that is detrimental to the public, which is in the Constitution, advertently or inadvertently, is there anything wrong with suggesting that that should be attended to by Parliament, obviously using its own procedures?
The public protector may make a recommendation if either a rule, a regulation, a law, in some way it causes maladministration. The public protector may make a recommendation. It is a recommendation which the legislature, once the report is tabled, the legislature can decide either to interact with the executive to find out whether it's possible or not, or if they want, they can reject the report. The legislature has got the right to reject the report of the public protector.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that is in a situation where it's a recommendation. I don't know.
Yeah, no. I'm asking, don't worry about any other situation. I'm just asking you whether I'm making a mistake because I have not even read it. What I'm about to read to you, I was saying I'm prefacing it. Yeah. I'm simply saying that if the public protector recommends that Parliament looks into a particular constitutional amendment. Okay, maybe let me put it this way because that's what is being alleged here. That the public protector is prescribing to Parliament, which is, to me, is just nonsensical there. Would it stop? Let's assume she did that. Would Parliament then have to make that amendment, or will it have to follow its own procedures? And if it doesn't meet the numbers, it doesn't meet the numbers. That's the point I'm trying to get at.
Yes, Parliament would have to follow its own procedures only if it accepts such reports,
yeah,
once the report is tabled.
Good. In other words, if Parliament doesn't challenge it, the Parliament might also challenge it. Correct. Fair enough. Okay. Now let's go to Venice Principle number 18. It's 322. Thanks. In the framework of the monitoring of the implementation at the national level of ratified international instruments relating to human rights and fundamental freedoms of the harmonization of national legislation with the instruments of the ombudsman, the ombudsman shall have the power to present in public recommendations to Parliament or the executive, including to amend legislation or to adopt new legislation. And I'm including the Constitution as the super legislation, but under that rubric, would then be anything wrong for the public protector presenting recommendations for the amendment of legislation or the Constitution or the adoption of new legislation? Or let me put it this way, why does the Venice Principles, in your estimation, why do they specifically deal with that power and isolate it as a power which the public protector should have?
Because when the lawmakers have the intention to prescribe a law, it is only in its practical implementation whether you know whether that law causes justice or injustice. It may look good on paper, but once it is in the hands of the people who implement the law, that is the executive, then it will come up under the scrutiny of the public protector. And then they may have to make certain recommendations to say, in its practical implementation, this law is not is good or bad, just or unjust, and we feel that it should be reviewed.
Right. Okay, well, we don't like that in this country. I must tell them in Venice. Okay. Then the next one also deals with that same subject, but now from a, an attacking point of view. In other words, when there's already some unconstitutionality, I was saying that the it says, yeah, following an investigation, the ombudsman shall preferably have the power to challenge the constitutionality of laws and regulations or general administrative acts. I suppose this is the flip side of the of principle number 18, where the that's the friendly part. That's principle 18, where the public protector would recommend an amendment of the constitution. Here it went to now wants to challenge particular constitutionality of an existing statute or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's, I suppose, the importance is the same as what you've already described.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. All right. Let's jump to 21. At the bottom, I'll just read out, the independent financial audit of the ombudsman's budget shall take into account only the legality of financial proceedings and not the choice of priorities in the execution of the mandate. Now, this is important in relation to the functional autonomy discussion we had earlier. Why do you think Venice says that the scrutinization of the financial audit of the PP should not go into the choice of priorities, for example, whether you put money in this or don't. That's the stuff we're talking about, the operational decisions. There's something here called reckless litigation, but we'll come to that later. As to whether she allocates the budget to this or that and the other, should the budget be scrutinized by Parliament to that extent in the context, not of the normal accounting of Parliament, but in the context of a removal in particular?
Insofar as ombudsmanship is concerned, everyone comes equal before the ombudsman. So the reason why an ombudsman may pursue a particular complaint and not pursue another complaint is the discretion of the ombudsman. So long as the reasoning and the rationale is contained in the report. So, yeah, there is no need really to question the reason why a particular complaint was followed, or this complaint was not followed. So long as the complaint falls within the mandate of the public protector. And most of our clients are vulnerable people who have no money. So you may find that actually you may be spending a lot more to investigate these complaints of the vulnerable people, which are maybe far away in the nether regions of the country.
Yes.
So this is the reason why that a particular provision is phrased in the way that it is.
Yes. I think it's, it would be fair to say that all the instruments that we have referred to, UN, IOI, IOMA, Venice, all of them, without fail, emphasize this issue of the, let's call it budgetary independence on the one hand and budgetary sufficiency. In other words, one of the ways in which an office of the ombudsman could be victimized is by squeezing it of resources, isn't it?
That is correct.
Right. Now, in regard to principle number 21, and I'm bringing it home here, is it fair for an institution such as Parliament to which the public protector has appealed endlessly to have this budgetary self-sufficiency, and for good or bad reasons, those budgetary requirements have not been met. And then, therefore, she then implements measures like performance management and all sorts of things to ensure that within the limited means that are there, she can still deliver. And then that same institution turns around and says, now we're going to remove you for the your way of managing the limited resources. Isn't that an internal contradiction?
Yeah, that is an attack actually on the functional independence of the institution of the ombudsman.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, then let's go to 22, which in my view still deals with something you've already spoken about hiring and firing. So the ombudsman institution shall have sufficient staff and appropriate structural flexibility. The institution may include one or more deputies appointed by the ombudsman. The ombudsman shall be able to recruit his or her staff. That's the hiring. And we agreed that the corollary of that is the firing. How does that measure up to this issue of internal autonomy, functional autonomy? The power to recruit and
yes, fire. Yes, this particular speaks to the administrative independence of the office of the ombudsman. It's very, very important that the staff of the ombudsman and the ombudsman himself are not compromised in any way, simply because they owe allegiance to a particular organ of government.
Yeah, thank you. And then the next one also deals with functional immunity. 23, almost there, Chair. So the ombudsman, the deputies, and the decision-making staff shall be immune from legal process in respect of activities and words spoken or written, carried out in their official capacity for the institution, functional immunity. Such functional immunity shall also apply to the ombudsman and deputies of the decision-making staff leave the institution. So you can see how seriously this is taken, that it's even after the person has left, they should still enjoy that immunity. But in relation to what we were saying, people come here and say, no, the public protector said this, yes, we must call her madam and all sorts of things like that. But this document says that she should be immune from legal process in respect of activities and words can or written carried out in their official capacity for the institution. Now, I want to make this clear. When we say these things, it doesn't mean that there must be impunity. But what is the purpose of that immunity? What is it in aid of to protect the public protector from this kind of interference, from the functioning of her office in terms of Section 181(4) of our Constitution, which I read out to you earlier. What, as I said, I ask you these things for the underlying principles. Why are they immunized functionally?
The main reason is to ensure the independence of the Office of the Ombudsman from the institution which it investigates, which is the executive. So the members of staff of the Ombudsman office may be followed up even after they have left work to come and maybe testify against an ombudsman who is still in office. Mm. So in order to avoid such conflicts of interest happening, this is the reason why there's such a focus in the Venice Principles to ensure the independence and to protect the integrity of the office.
Yeah. Okay. In other words, that if, let's say, somebody did whatever, all these horrible things that were explained here, that public protector would be immunized even after leaving office.
Even after leaving office.
Let alone while they are serving the office.
Yes.
All right. Then this is what I call, if you are a religious person, you can go and read Matthew 27, about Pontius Pilate. It says, the state shall refrain from taking any action aiming at or resulting in the suppression of the ombudsman institution or in any hurdles to its effective functioning and shall effectively protect it from any such threats. That's the issue of reprisals, the an illegal suspension by the president, and so on. Now, if states have a duty to ensure that this does not happen, I know I've asked you this question before, is there room then for a parliament to say, well, as far as those threats are there, it's got nothing to do with us?
The particular provision speaks to states in the abstract, and I think when they say states, they mean all the three arms of government.
Mm.
So it speaks to the government as a whole, as one, that they should refrain from occasioning any administrative or legal threats against the Office of the Ombudsman.
Thank you. And by the way, to carry on with my biblical allusion, yeah, Pontius Pilate knew that participated in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, knowing that he was innocent, but he was scared of losing his job or being in disfavor with Caesar. That it has nothing to do with anyone in this room. But I'm just saying that is it that kind of behavior of saying, look, I probably know that you are innocent and I'm washing my hands of the blood, but still carrying out the function against the threats, obvious threats. And threats, I mean, yeah, objectively, it might not be a real threat, but it might be a reasonable perception of a threat because the person is being investigated or whatever. Can a protector, and I know I'm asking this for the third time, can a body entrusted with the protection of the public protector absolve itself from the responsibility to protect her from those threats?
And
you see just now why I'm asking this question so
much. Yes, the institution of the Ombudsman was created to investigate the executive and to be accountable to Parliament. And the reason why that was so was to ensure that through the principle of the separation of powers, the office of the ombudsman can seek refuge and shelter from parliament against the excesses of the executive.
Thank you. Thank you. You see, that's the best answer so far. All right. That takes us, madam, to page 344. And this is now Honorable Kajuju's territory. And if I'm sufficiently provoked, I'll call her as a witness to defend her document. Can I go to 344? But you also have operated at that level. You're the treasurer.
Yes, I'm the treasurer.
She can delegate that task to you. Now, here, and this is quite important for this question that I've asked you many times. The IOI, International Ombudsman Institute, has seen it fit to produce a document called 344.
The difficulty with this, trying to navigate these documents, is that they are saved separately.
Okay. No, that's fine. Sorry, Tupo. I thought that this one is called the IOI Guidelines on the Support to Colleagues Under Threat. We submitted it, I think, on Friday and again yesterday. So that might assist you in finding it. Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay. Yes. Okay. Page 344, Madam Sokwane. So this is the document which was approved by the Board of Directors in Bangkok in November 2016. Now, here, this one deals specifically with the threats that we've been talking about in theory of reprisal, unfair suspensions and that kind of thing. Yeah. And it says the purpose of these guidelines is to establish principles and courses of action to coordinate IOI support for ombudsmen coming under threat, facing reprisals, or operating under difficult circumstances. Sorry, the joke there is that this document was obviously written by an English-speaking person, because they've put ombudsmen in plural as if it was English, yeah. But it's actually a Swedish term, but that's another one. But anyway, it says, I were aware that those threats are arising also in the middle of growing challenges and threats to human rights in many countries. In other words, the threats against public protectors become part of the general lawlessness or abuse of human rights in a particular country, correct? Mm. Now, this document, I found it particularly depressing. Let's go to definition at 345, because I hope Madame Kajuju is not listening. I think if she uses this document, we are gone. The definition says, yeah, threats to ombudsman institutions come in a variety of forms, but have a common denominator. They come as a direct response to the complaint handling work of the ombudsman and their efforts to protect human rights and fight corruption. Okay. So again, fighting corruption is usually against the powerful forces, public and private, in any society, correct?
Correct.
And then it says, for the purposes of these guidelines, threats should be defined as any action that is directed towards an ombudsman institution or an incumbent, directly or indirectly, that potentially puts the independent operation and exercise of the ombudsman's duties at risk. All the examples we've said before, unlawful suspension, direct threats, even physical threats to physical life, correct?
Yes, if you could refer to Annex 1, maybe. I don't know what page it is.
Sorry?
They are listed in under Annex 1.
Yes, no, we're going there. That's the part that is depressing me. Okay, can I just say, I think broadly we've covered this in the morning, Honorable Kajuju would assist us there. I mean, the worst case scenario is if someone encourages this or turns the blind eye to such threats, it could potentially face expulsion. I know it's not as easy as that, but it's one of the consequences, correct?
Yes.
Thank you. And now, and one of the things that the IOI at 347 may do in a country, if a country does anything that looks like is in breach of this protocol, would be, bullet 1, 2, 3, 4, to establish a commission of inquiry to take evidence in the country concerned, if necessary, and report to the executive committee. Obviously, we know where that might lead us.
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah. And sending an IOI delegation to study the problem on the field. Well, they're already here.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Now, here's the depressing part. At page 349, there's a list of what you call possible threats to ombudsman institutions. Okay? And they are listed there 14. I've added a 15th one, but which I call unlawful retaliatory suspension. But we'll get there just now. And the depressing part is that actually, I think South Africa, given this process that's taking place here, fails all 15 or 14 of these. But let's see what the scorecard would say. This process, and maybe before we get into this, let me preface it by asking you. You said in one of our consultations that one of the things we are missing is that the world is watching us as we're doing this process. And also you link that to the what you call the Pan-Africanist mission or role of South Africa as to lead in these kinds of things. Can you just talk about that? The world is watching, we know because you are here and Madam Kajuju is here, but maybe you are right, maybe we are too internally focused. What are the dangers or the opportunities in us doing this exercise properly or wrongly or improperly? Yeah.
The South African example is a particularly poignant one for me because from the time of your independence, you have strived to ensure that you implement democratic constitutionalism in this country. Your constitution, I think, is a model for many, and you have established the appropriate oversight institutions in this country. Particularly, the institution of the ombudsman has been a leader in Africa simply by the fact that the African Ombudsman and Research Center is housed in this country, and this country has also supported ombudsmanship. So you are a leader. I would call you a leader in the field of human rights and ombudsmanship in Africa. So what has been going on here in South Africa is actually very telling on the continent. And that is why it is important for us. This is the reason why in the OR Tambo Declaration, we have included the African Union Commission in that document. And under, I think, Article 14 of the
OR Tambo.
On the Charter on Democracy, Elections, and Good Governance, the African Union's Charter, we have agreed with the African Union that we will spread the concept of the ombudsman in Africa, in the spirit of course, Pan-Africanism, really, to ensure that institutions of good governance are established, especially the institution of the ombudsman. So I say this because recently, of course, there was a judgment that came out of South Africa. I think it was Economic Freedom Fighters and the Reserve Bank,
the
Speaker of the National Assembly. Yes, yes. Where the powers of the ombudsman were discussed in that paper, in that judgment. And I think it was, I hope I have the right case.
I think,
it's Reserve Bank of South Africa.
You know, if you're talking about Reserve Bank, then that's a different one. If EFF is the Nkandla report, the one
Nkandla report
we discussed in the morning, which was about binding reports, you are probably talking about Public Protector versus South African Reserve Bank.
The 2019 judgment.
2019 volume 6 SA and all of that. Yeah. Okay. Yes. You're talking about the one to do with Reserve Bank and the mandate and amendment of the constitution.
Yeah, where the constitutional court I think challenged the mandate of the public protector, stating that it's not, their powers are not equivalent to a court.
Yes, okay, good.
Yes.
Now then, yeah, you're talking about the Reserve Bank. That's the CX. It deals with one of the charges here, yeah. So
exactly.
The judgment you're talking about where there was a majority judgment and a minority judgment of the Chief Justice?
Yes.
Okay, yes, that's the Reserve Bank judgment, yes. Okay, yes. Now, okay, we'll come back to that judgment. I'll deal with it to you first thing. When we're dealing with the judgment at later on. By the way, just for my own edification for now, so that I know whether to lead you on that judgment or not later, or how to lead you on it. Just high level, the majority in that judgment dealt with some of the things we're speaking about here. Scathing criticism to the public protector and even imposed personal costs. And the minority judgment, I think, was of the view that the principles of public protector of an institution like that would be breached if the court went that far. Which of those two judgments, the majority or the minority, do you agree with?
Well, speaking as an ombudsman, really, I must agree with the minority judgment, yes.
Yes. All right, we'll get back to that at a later stage. You were now busy telling us about the AU involvement, and just for quick reference, Chair, it's page 271. I'll read it out. That's the last page of the OR Tambo principles. It says implement measures aimed at accelerating the implementation of the AU shared values, giving priority to the AU Charter on Democracy, actively disseminate provisions of the Charter that relate to governance with special attention, and so on. Is that the section you're talking about where the next stage is to try and have these principles adopted at AU level?
Exactly.
And it's a double question, which is how far are we in that process? Have we yet succeeded?
At this juncture, I think because of the COVID,
uh-huh.
this is what interrupted the whole issue. But we do have, I think, observer status
mm-hmm.
at the AU.
Uh-huh.
And I hope we'll now take it up further now that the COVID crisis is over.
Yes. And by the way, talking about expulsion, which we spoke about earlier in the context of IOI, do you know what the situation is with the European Union vis-a-vis membership of that body of a country that flouts the principles?
I can't recall the particular provision, but I must say I was informed by one of the members of the IOI Board of Directors
mm-hmm.
that a member that is does not have an institution of the ombudsman cannot continue to be a member of the EU, or if a country is applying to be a member of the EU, they must have an institution of the ombudsman, otherwise they cannot be admitted as a member of the EU.
Yes. No, what I'm getting at is, well, you can have an ombudsman institution, can call it what you like. But if you had one that does not comply to the Venice principles, for example, would you be admitted?
If a country is not compliant, I wouldn't be able to say. I'm not an authority on the EU. I wouldn't be able to say.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. We'll find that information. Now, the reason why I was prefacing that question is, insofar as you are trying to get the AU now, African Union, to follow suit, would that be the direction that hopefully one day membership, or rather the having a compliant institution of ombudsman would be one of the criteria for participation at that level?
Exactly.
Thank you. Okay. Now let's go back to, you can see I'm running away from that list that I was saying is depressing me, but we have to go through it. So the first thing is restrictions of budget or staff on budget or staff. Well, we feel I think the witnesses that have come here have said that the budget is clearly one of the most serious constraints.
Given the nature of the witness, I haven't kicked up a fuss about lady, but I think if the witnesses can conclude that the country has failed in any reasons of this, then it must be based on reasons that the witness believes, so not Advocate Mpofu's evidence in that regard. I mean, the leading is...
I'm not listening anything. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm saying that the witnesses that have come here, Ms. Mutsisi, Tejane, maybe to some extent Mohaladi, I'm sure there are more, have all said that the budget, there's even a document, I can't remember, it was supplied to us by you, which specifically states that the one of the weaknesses in this country is the inadequacy of the budget. I think this is almost common cause. So now, I don't know.
Chair, there's a difference between a suggestion that the budget which is provided to the public office, public protector's office, is inadequate to meet its needs, and a suggestion that there's a threat to the institution, or as punishment or form of retribution, money is taken away from the institution.
I didn't say that.
I didn't say that. I'm suggesting to you that when you do that, let's just be clear about what is being put to the witness and what this is saying. Yes.
Okay, thank you, Advocate Bauer.
Okay, thank you, sir. All right. I don't know what's happening now. Yeah, I'm just giving you information that about 3 or 4 of the witnesses, which were called by the evidence leaders, have confirmed in writing and in memoranda that were presented here. And I don't think anybody denies this. Even our parliament cannot deny it. It's because we have many other demands, like everyone else. But it's common cause that there is inadequacy of the budget for the Office of the Public Protector. And the Public Protector has said it probably in every meeting she has ever attended to the Portfolio Committee. So I don't know what the issue is. I'm saying to you that, because you are an outsider, unlike me, that, or even more, you were not here to listen to all the witnesses. I'm saying that this issue should not be contentious, because the witnesses of the evidence leaders have confirmed it. Can you just accept that as information?
I will state that most ombudsman offices are underfunded. Mm. Even in Africa, even in Europe and America, they complain about the funding to the office. I can't say about the funding to this office, but I know for a fact that most offices are underfunded.
Yes, thank you very much. Okay. And then the next one is unlawful removal of incumbents. That's another threat, isn't it, let's not be generous. The heading is not, it's called possible threats to ombudsman institutions. Another possible threat would be an unlawful removal of an incumbent, let's say, for example, arising from a flawed or unfair process, correct?
Yes, we have had examples where ombudsmen have tried to appeal for assistance either to AOMA, the IOI, where they feel that they're being removed. Being removed unlawfully.
Mm.
So that's the reality. It does happen.
Yes. And then the next one is the failure to appoint or elect a new incumbent. Okay, this one, we can leave it at the level of a threat. Obviously, something like that might happen if there's, let's say, there's a legal process that interdicts the appointment of a new incumbent.
Yeah, it is a threat, actually. We have had, I think, one African country that has even completely I think it has completely removed the office of the ombudsman even from its constitution. The office just doesn't exist. I can't remember which country it is. So for us, it was a threat. Hmm. It was a concern. And there are some countries where there's supposed to be an ombudsman and there's no ombudsman appointed. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. And by the way, talking about new incumbents, I'll ask you this. I'll try to ask it theoretically. If a particular incumbent, let's say, was left with 6 months of a term of office, and a particular country pursues the removal of that person at the estimated cost of 1 million rand per day, given load shedding and all sorts of things. I shouldn't have mentioned load shedding. Does that make sense? In other words, if you have a costly exercise to remove a person who is halfway to the door, basically, and I'm saying that apropos the threats that might pose, for example, to the process of appointing a new incumbent, let alone the process of handing over to that new incumbent by the old one, which is what would be indicative of, I'm just exaggerating for effect. Let's say a person has left with 2 weeks, and then we start a process like this, and spend so much money and time and resources and lawyers and what have you. Is that consistent with, or rather, is that, should that be seen as a threat or something to be encouraged?
Really depends on the gravity of the charges that have been pressed against,
yes,
that particular ombudsman.
Uh-huh. Yeah, let's say, yeah, if like they killed everyone in the office, I'm sure even if they were left to the one day, we have to do something.
Yes.
But go back to the examples that I was giving
you
about
the
HR and judgments and all.
Yeah, if there is actually no substantial charges against that person, it's just on the whim of any authority to just have that person removed, of course it can be perceived to be a reprisal.
Yes. Thank you. Right. The next threat is called political pressure on incumbents. Oh, there. I don't want to bore you with the details. I gave you an example of the judgment. Yeah. So the next one, number 5, is incorrect charges on incumbents resulting in arrest. Now let's pause here. You mentioned the Reserve Bank case, where the judgment that you don't like, the one that imposes personal costs on the public protector. What's wrong with that? In terms of what we've been discussing, the principles.
Well, really, it looks like the functional immunity of the office has actually been stripped away completely. But having said that, I don't know how it is here with the South African system, but I think in our system, for someone to be the personal cost or the cost of another party, I think that person would have had to be, the office holder would have had to be a party to the proceedings, really, from the way I understand it.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
No, fair enough. That's true. Well, I tried to argue that once in the Constitutional Court, it didn't find favor. But assume for a minute that the person is a party. I'm saying that from an institutional independence point of view, is it a good thing to then pursue the person personally as a person?
No.
For work that was done in the capacity as a public protector or an ombudsman?
The person is functioning officially, mm-hmm, in their office. They are not carrying out a personal duty. So, it really compromises the independence and integrity of the office for the officer to be it a personal, mm-hmm, responsibility,
yeah,
for actions that were carried out in an official capacity.
Thank you. And as if that's not enough, for the same transgression, quote unquote, of the CX matter. This one offended very big, powerful people. Yeah. So apart from being marked with personal costs, the public protector is also facing criminal charges. And that goes to that threat of incorrect charges on incumbents resulting in arrest. Okay, sure. Thank God she was not arrested. But for the very same thing for which you say she should not have been subjected to personal costs, the very, very same thing. She's also being charged criminally. What does that do for institutional independence?
I think this goes to the very heart of ombudsmanship, that the Office of the Ombudsman was set up to investigate the executive. So that's my opinion. I don't think that the executive arm of government should be allowed to get back at the ombudsman using the court system, because these are the costs. First of all, in the issue of the costs, these are the costs which were supposed to be borne by the respondent institution, and then they are cast upon the public protector personally. And then secondly, to have criminal charges cast against the public protector, again, arising from the same set of circumstances, it really does, it does sound like victimization. I'm really sorry to say it. It's a bit much, because this is, again, I must go back to my previous statement that this is an office that is constituted as a corporate. So, so this is a single person in an office being asked to shoulder the responsibility of an entire organization, because there is an entire system that is behind her or him.
Yeah. Well, that is what it is, as they say. What about double jeopardy? Is it, if the person has already been punished rightly or wrongly in the court, is it fair to then punish them again in the criminal court for the same thing?
Repeat the question, please.
If a person has been punished by punitive cost, the word punitive means punishing. If a person has been punished by the imposition of punitive costs, is it fair to punish them criminally for the same thing? It's called double jeopardy.
Okay, I mean, in the criminal law, you will find an accused person, you know, at the end, a convict, and say, well, you pay a fine, and a failure, if you're paying this fine, you face imprisonment for so long. So this means that it's an either or situation. It can't be both.
Okay, thank you. And okay, the next one is organizational changes. Okay, we can jump that. That obviously follows from, for example, an unlawful suspension, then will lead to organizational changes. The next one says changes of mandate or statute, legislative initiatives that could impact on the office. I think we've dealt with the issue of the mandate, that the mandate should, for example, the thing that happened in your country, where the mandate was changed from an executive to a parliamentary process. Let's assume in some, earlier you and I called a step backward, that you then move from the parliamentary framework back towards an executive framework. Surely that would be a threat, correct?
Yes.
All right.
Let's pause there. Just take tea break.
Tea break. Oh, thank you, sir.
5 minutes.
Yes.
I'll be back at 1:15. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Recording stopped.
Chairperson, sorry, I just lost my place. That's fine. Thank you. We're at page 349. Yes. Okay, I'll try and go through this quicker. We just did number 7. Number 8 is reduction of formal independence. We covered this earlier in the morning. That's obviously a threat to the institution, correct?
Oh, yes, please.
Yes. And that reduction can come in many ways, either undermining functional immunity or, you know, subjecting the public protector to unnecessary pressure and all that. Okay, and then unstable political environment. Okay, so I spoke about factionalism. So this may or may not be a threat, again, depending on a country. In your country, for example, we've heard that there have been 5 different governments, 3 different parties.
Yes.
And yet that was not used. It was not really a threat. Well, maybe it was, but at least not one that was unmanageable. You may share, if you are free to do so, you don't have to, whether there were any challenges around the changes of government here and there, but which were managed.
No, there were no challenges, except that there was just ignorance. I think ignorance is one of the ombudsman's biggest challenges, yes. So you would get people who, when there's a change of government, who would ask, but you're still in office, you know? So just not understanding that there's that aspect of security of tenure for the office of the ombudsman.
No, fair enough. Okay. No, I think that's a fair statement. So ignorance, sometimes it's not that people are being malicious, but there's just sheer ignorance.
Yes.
So for example, if someone says, well, we're just going to be bound by judgments or a suspension has nothing to do with us, it might not be coming from a place of being malicious, but just pure ignorance of how these things work, correct?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. And then it says defamation of incumbents and or staff or media. I've told you that in our case, the public protector, there's a political party that called her a spy from day one, in fact, from day zero, before she started on day one. And that was a subject of a defamation suit that went up to the Supreme Court of Appeal. That's another way of undermining the independence of public protector, isn't it? Just pure sheer insult.
Yes, it can happen, definitely.
Right. And then administrative or judicial harassment. I read you out the judgment about reprisal from the president in our case. The judicial harassment, I don't know about that, but it says administrative or judicial harassment. So that both the administration, which is the executive side, or the judiciary could be an instrument to harass a public protector, correct?
Yes, definitely. The administration could be prosecuting or commencing civil actions against the ombudsman, and the judiciary may also play along to the gallery. Yes, it's possible.
You also said something earlier about the judiciary, and this is about the next topic that we're going to discuss. But just in this context, that the judiciary would feel less threatened, I think, in a situation where the remedial action is recommendations,
yes,
than when it is binding. Can you explain that? And in what way would that play into this space of the judiciary being part of the threat?
I think from my experience, it seems like they perceive the Office of Ombudsman as creating a parallel court system.
Uh-huh.
When you give the ombudsman binding powers.
Uh-huh.
But when the reports of the ombudsman only have the effect of a recommendation, usually there isn't so much interplay with the judiciary. They have no reason to interfere in the functions of the office.
Yes. And, okay, well, I'll make that example maybe later when the public protector testifies. But one of the, or two of the judgments in this particular case relate to a section of the Public Protector Act that gives the public protector the discretion to investigate matters that are older than 2 years.
Yes.
And the, well, I almost said the obvious, yeah. But the interpretation of that section, there are two possible interpretations. You can interpret it as the public protector has power, extensive powers, but she has a discretion to investigate even if something is 100 years old, if it's important. Or you can interpret it as a normal prescription thing that says thou shall not investigate something that's over 2 years, even if the person stole 200 billion rand. And if it's 1 week late, then you can't touch it. And this is the kind of issue where this in judgments that I'm talking about is the Gordhan and Pillay judgments. The courts went to say that no, you may not, the public protector has basically prohibited, and she even got another personal cost for that, from investigating the rogue unit in that case, just because it was discovered or rather it was brought to her X number of years after the actual activities. Now, I'm saying in that kind of space, do you think that it would, if it's a binding regime or a recommendation regime, that kind of clash between the judiciary and the public protector might have been avoided?
Yes. Definitely, it was going to be avoided for the fact that nobody has to worry when the report is only supported by recommendations. But where the report is supported by binding decisions, then people worry and they say, what is the effect of this particular investigation going to be? But having said that, again, it is in a way an injustice for the members of the public when the time limit for submitting complaints to the Office of the Public Protector is read very, very narrowly, because there are always exceptions to that rule. For example, for poor people who come from the rural areas, they may not know that they can actually appeal.
Mm.
They may not have the money to actually reach the office of the ombudsman, and they may take more than 2 years to bring a complaint to the office of the ombudsman. So usually that particular clause is read very, very loosely, and it actually gives even the ombudsman discretion in a lot of jurisdictions, discretion to have some exceptions to the general rule.
Yes. Well, okay. Well, in our country, it has been now three times actually, I think, even in the James case, just seen as a prohibition rather than something, let's call it an enabling statute, which actually gives her the leeway to intervene if the situation so demands. Okay. And then attacks on incumbents, verbal or written. Okay, that goes with the spy example and defamation. It's the same thing. And I think she's even been called the enemy of the state or something. Ill treatment of incumbents. Well, we can spend the whole day on this. What happens? Why do people lose their humanity and treat a person like as if they are an object? They don't have family, they don't have any feelings, they can just be vilified and ganged up against and subjected to blatantly unfair and biased treatment. What drives that? Okay, I know as far as the executive is concerned, it's obviously a form of reprisal. But generally, if other institutions such as Parliament or any other institution?
I think in a lot of instances where these things are happening, it is because the Office of the Ombudsman is not being accorded the appropriate protections according which have been set as a standard at international law. So we can again put it down to ignorance, I think, for want of better words, I think sometimes it's just overzealousness, you know. Not knowing that there are particular standards that have to be accorded to this particular office when you're dealing with this particular office, and looking at the nature of the job that this particular office holder carries out, and then ensuring that because the office holder is carrying out a very unique responsibility, therefore there have to be appropriate rules, regulations, and standards that have to be accorded to this office when you are carrying out any process against that office.
Okay. And yeah, thank you. And the double standards, what brings that about? For example, what drives a political party or individuals from acting like, if it's the public protector, the fact that she might be reviewing the process, they say, no, we're continuing. But when it's one of their own, if it's the president, then because it's a review, no, we're not continuing. Party line, what have you? What brings that kind of double standards on opportunism and duplicity?
For that, I think, again, I will speak to the fact that this particular office, again, is vulnerable because it investigates the executive. So double standards are going to be used in order to rein in the office, yes, to ensure that the office does not carry out its duties, the duties that it was accorded by statute or by the constitution.
Yes. Okay. Maybe I'm putting the question too vaguely, or because you are not familiar with our situation. I'm saying that if the same, literally the same logic applies to two situations, let's say if the impeachment of the public protector and the impeachment of the president, and then the same people behave differently. In other words, in the one case, the ill treatment comes in the form of, well, we don't care whether you're going to court or not. But in the other one, it is, okay, because you're going to court, we'll spare you. Another, coming from the very same people, what does that say about the integrity of the country or the threat to the first institution?
Well, it is definitely a threat to the office of the ombudsman when two or more entities come against the office and try to use whether it's the law or they try to use administrative rules and regulations against the office. So it is a definite threat to the office, and that is the reason why.
And then the last one on that list is death threats to incumbents and staff. Okay, we know that there have been security threats to, and I'm sure it's not unique to us. One of the guidelines say that there should be adequate security measures provided, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And then, as I said, the last one, which I added, number 15, just to make it a round figure, was an unlawful or retaliatory suspension. That would be a threat as well, correct?
Yeah, it falls under administrative or judicial harassment.
Yes. And while we're on the subject of judicial harassment, if we have a situation where the courts make it fashionable to punish the public protector with personal costs, would that form part of judicial harassment?
Yes, personal costs, really, I have to agree that it forms part of judicial harassment. It is totally unacceptable.
Yes. No, I'm saying, yes, you've made that point. I'm saying personal costs, let's assume for now that the personal costs was an acceptable way of dealing with a public protector. I'm asking a different question, which is, if the courts make it fashionable, in other words, it's instinctive, this judge gave the personal costs, therefore I'll also give personal costs, and therefore the third one will also give personal costs, and it becomes literally almost instinctive to do so. What does that do for the independence of the office? This is the situation you said, you read the Commissioner for SARS, the situation that was described in the, by the Constitutional Court in the Commissioner for SARS case.
Yes. It really weakens the office, because the courts of law are a place of refuge. If you cannot go to the courts of law for protection, if there is no impartiality, then the office really is completely stripped of the basic protection that should be accorded, not even the office, the office holder.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll deal with that. Well, you should have accepted that judgeship, because that word was exactly what Judge Madanga used to say, if you do that, you weaken the office. And he said, therefore you weaken our democracy. But we'll deal with that tomorrow morning when we do the cases. Right. Now, the general question, we've gone through this list of 14 or 15 criteria, and to be generous, we probably score less than 10%. Now, what should a country do? I mean, objectively now, forget about partisanship and so on. If you had a situation like this process here, and you called an objective person and say, how do we fare against these 15 criteria? And you find that on all of them, or 14 or 15 or 13 of them, you are found wanting. obviously you should be worried as a country, but what lessons can be drawn from that situation and what should we do going forward? If I'm right that we failed dismally.
I think going forward, it's very, very important for states to look at the institution of the ombudsman, not just from a narrow perspective of the as a national institution, but to also look at its international personality. Because really, we are trying to build democratic institutions, for example, for Africa, throughout Africa. And it's very, very important that what we reflect in our jurisdictions can also be replicated in other jurisdictions. So it's just an issue of asking oneself if what is going on in my jurisdiction can be allowed to happen in another jurisdiction. And just adhere to the standards, really. Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Now I want to deal with shall we call it the virtues. It can be nice if you are in power to have a situation where you're going to be scrutinized by an ombudsman. And, you know, when you are supposed to have all the power to yourself. But I think our founding president, Sir Nelson Mandela, explained it so well that it is actually the government volunteers to have such scrutiny for the sake not of itself, but of the public. And again, that's a point that's always missed in these conversations. And maybe the best way to illustrate it, Madame Fakoni, is by going back to basics. You've said this is an institution that started more than 300 years ago, actually 310 years ago. And it started in Sweden, as you indicated, in 1713.
Yes.
And I'm now going to paragraph 10 of your statement. 1713, just to give you perspective, was 60 years. We were still fighting different things. 60 years after the arrival of Jan van Riebeeck, and 30 years after the arrival of another chap called Simon van der Stel, after whom a place called Stellenbosch was named. Yeah. So the wisdom of that king of Sweden is something that if he didn't do what he did, we wouldn't be sitting here, for example. But what do you think drove the Swedish king in 1713 to say, I'm an all-powerful monarch, I've got all this power, but there should be an institution that actually scrutinizes me on behalf of the people? From which we have all benefited, depending where you sit. I think Advocate Mkhwebane has not benefited from that. She's suffering from it. But as people, if you can just then help us to trace this institution over those centuries, from the 18th century when it was established in 1713 up to where we are, broadly speaking, not year by year, because otherwise it would be year.
There's a pause. I've forgotten both. I've forgotten that one.
Sorry, Chair, in assisting my colleague in us being able to move on, I'm not sure if last year we had this conversation. I thought we did, but we might not have. We don't take issue with paragraphs 10 to 16, which set out the historical background. And unless it's got something specific to the motion, we're happy to accept the contents of those paragraphs as they stated in the affidavit.
Okay, thank you. Let's get them off.
No, thank you, Chair. Yeah, no, that's very useful. Yeah. But the point I'm really making is maybe a more profound one, more than whether the evidence leaders accept the evidence or not. It is to describe the nature of an institution where the holders of power surrender that power voluntarily for the benefit of the public. And I'm saying from 1713 up to now, 310 years later, that is still the underlying principle of ombudsman institutions, isn't it?
Just answer it very quickly, very briefly.
Yeah.
So when the Swedish king, I think there was some disturbance in the kingdom. He had fled Sweden,
mm-hmm.
and he had actually gone to Turkey for refuge.
Mm.
So when he went to Turkey for refuge, he found this concept of an official who handles complaints from the public on behalf of the ruler of Turkey. So he took this concept back when he went back to Sweden and I think made peace. The only way he made peace was to introduce this concept of the ombudsman to say, I will cede some of my powers, this official who will take complaints against the excesses of the king.
Mm.
And eventually, I think as the institution evolved by 1809, they had set up parliaments and things like that. And this official became answerable to parliament and not to the king. They had refined the system. They were refining the system from 1713 up to about 1809. They had refined the system.
About 100 years.
Yes. So now to take the context to the present, when Tanzania set up the Office of the Ombudsman mm-hmm. in 1966, the Tanzanian president then, I think, had set up a one-party state. And because he had set up a one-party state,
mm-hmm.
people were anxious that with this one-party state, if we have complaints, where are we going to be complaining to? So this is when he set up this Office of the Ombudsman to tell people that if you have a complaint, you can go to the ombudsman and the ombudsman investigates all officials. I think they were investigating all officials, whether they were for the legislature, the executive, or the judiciary. And this was replicated in Zambia in 1973. The 1973 constitution was the one which barred multi-party politics.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Kaunda set up a one-party state.
Mm-hmm.
And he, too, I think in order to convince the people that yes, this one party state can work, he then established the Office of the Ombudsman. It was then called the Office of the Investigator General.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, you can see that it was the Office of the Ombudsman was seen as a very powerful institution which could help to protect the public
mm-hmm.
against the excesses of the executive. So mm-hmm. from these three examples, I think
thank you very much. That covers that topic. You've dealt with, I think we've already dealt with the interplay between the three arms of the state, with what they should do versus what they should not do. In other words, they should be cross-checking each other, not collaborate against the public protector. We've dealt with that.
Yes. Mm. Well, I could also explain a little bit about that.
Mm.
In a proper working classical system, the ombudsman is, as I said, is appointed and be dismissed by the legislature. And the executive facilitates the establishment of this office and at the same time funds it. And then the judiciary gives this office the conditions of service. And by the judiciary giving this office the conditions of service, it helps the office from being isolated. Because if the office is isolated, the conditions of service are just hanging. They are just being picked at the discretion of either officials of the executive or parliament. This becomes a threat to the office of the ombudsman. So this is why it is very, very important that all three arms of government contribute to the establishment of the office. And this works as a protection for the office of the ombudsman.
Thank you. Sorry, I was missing my phone. Yes. Now, you've also, I think we've covered the, or rather, let's just do this so that we get it out of the way. You've made this reference to the classical versus the hybrid model and so on. Can you just very briefly explain what that's all about vis-a-vis the historical account of this office having evolved for the past 300 years and the first office in Africa having been established in 1966, as you say. And by the way, is it correct that the Africa first ombudsman institution predated some of similar institutions even in the so-called Western world?
Yes, the Office of the Ombudsman in Tanzania was established in 1966. The United Kingdom established its office in 1967. Mm. And a lot of the other countries started establishing ombudsman offices much later. Mm. I think even the United States and countries like that.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So, yeah, I just wanted to stress on the issue of the conditions of service. When the conditions of service of the ombudsman are not certain, it becomes a very, very big threat. And a lot of ombudsmen persons are having this problem.
Hmm.
So the issue of isolation, the ombudsman becomes isolated. The ombudsman cannot go to the executive, cannot talk to the executive.
Hmm.
The ombudsman goes to parliament, and through the whip system again, the ombudsman becomes defeated. And then, so the only other protection to prevent the ombudsman from being isolated is to have the conditions of service under the judiciary. So this is the system that is pertaining in Namibia. In Namibia, the ombudsman enjoys the terms and conditions of service of a judge. So the ombudsman doesn't have to fight for his own terms and conditions of service. He just waits. The judiciary themselves just negotiates with the government. And when they get their conditions of service, he's just written a letter to say, oh, these are your conditions of service. Now you need conditions of service. It's a protection.
Yeah.
Isolating the ombudsman to fight his or her own battles, especially with respect to the terms and conditions of service, is really, really a threat to the institution of the ombudsman.
Thank you. You know that what you've just said is probably lies at the heart of what we're dealing with here in many ways. So the Namibian situation is, I think, if it applied in South Africa, again, I keep on saying we wouldn't be here. When the public protector gives evidence, one of the things she will say talks to what you're saying now. Namely that there are actually no conditions of service. You are talking about conditions of service which must be adequate or whatever. Well, here there are zero. You just get appointed in parliament, you go to Pretoria, and We'll see how you get by for 7 years. Now, in that situation, is it fair, how can you even have a disciplinary process against what? You know, when if Parliament fails or the appointing body fails to give you even a one-page thing that says, okay, you must go to work at 8 and finish at 5 and take this and the other. You're just left on your own devices. And then when something happens, they say, oh, well, now we must chop your head. The same people who fail to give you conditions of service. Now, what you're saying is that in Namibia, it becomes easy because obviously the conditions of service of charges have been established over years. So all the public protector really has to do is to just fit in with that system.
Yes.
Now, what do you have to say about the situation where there's zero conditions of service, not even one, well, except for the Act and the Constitution, which we can all read, but there's no conditions of service?
That is a real threat to the independence of the office.
So I'm sorry, I missed that. Oh, I was just checking with the public protector. I'm just saying just to clarify that point. It's what in normal parlance is known as a job description. There's no such thing. So the office kind of develops its own guidelines just to make sure that there's a way of you know, dealing with the hierarchy, who does what. For example, she would delegate to the deputy public protector this and that power. Even that is left to her own devices, but we'll deal with that in another context. But can one who doesn't have a job description formally imposed, and I use that word advisedly, by the employer, quote unquote, be then disciplined by that employer, as I say, against what? What would be the yardstick?
I think these are the issues that go to the heart of the independence of the Office of the Public Protector. So for in my situation, also, the terms and conditions of service have not been given. But the new constitution states that where the public protector has to be disciplined, he'll be disciplined in the same way that a judge shall be disciplined.
Mm.
So it goes to the Judicial Complaints Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Someone can take complaint to the Complaints Commission.
Wow. Well, now imagine if we had that system of Namibia and Zambia, then the public protector would have been impossible to suspend her, because in our case in South Africa, it also goes to something called the Judicial Complaints Commission. Then it goes to something called the Judicial Conduct Tribunal, and only, which is like the equivalent of this committee. And only once that body finds you guilty, is the possibility of a suspension. And as I explained to you earlier, here it was for retaliatory purposes, it was accelerated. So the example, the advantages then of having the conditions of service at least, and that includes remuneration, car allowance, whatever, being the same as that of a judge, also include that functionality of not having to reinvent the wheel, correct?
I didn't catch the last.
Also, in one of the advantages is the fact that you don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Yes, you don't have to reinvent the wheel, and you don't. There's no retaliation against the office holder, you know, because, like, for instance, in my case, the terms and conditions of service were for so long not known that at the end it was just put within the civil service structure, just somewhere in the middle.
Mm.
So it becomes difficult again, because now you are saying that there are a number of officials within the executive who are at a higher salary scale. It means that they're senior to the public protector. And how can the public protector investigate those officials independently? So it goes against the whole concept of the independence of the ombudsman.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Well, again, on the positive side for South Africa, and I think this might even be an area where, I don't know, I've not done a comparative study where we are better than others, I hope. But in Section 9 of the Public Protector Act in South Africa actually goes a long way towards that as far as protection is concerned. And if I'm not correct, it might be one of a few examples that you can tell me if I'm wrong, where the public protector is actually protected by that section exactly in the same way as a judge, by contempt of court protection, where a person can go to jail literally in terms of Section 11 of that act for insulting the public protector. Well, not that it has stopped anyone from insulting her, but from at least theoretically, that section, I think Section 9(1)(b) actually uses the word in the same way as if it was a judge. So it says, if you insult the, oh, there you are, thank you. Section 9, it says, contempt of the public protector, which is basically the same as contempt of court. No person shall insult the public protector or the deputy public protector. And as I say, well, you'll be surprised. She's been called all sorts of things, including an agent of state capture and corrupt and what have you. And those people got away with it. But in A, it says, in connection, at B, in connection with an investigation, no person shall do anything which, if the said investigation had been proceeding in a court of law, would have constituted contempt of court. You see, total protection. I think, well, at least in the South African context, I think it's the only office that I know in this country that is protected with, literally in the same, to the same level of a judge. So surely that's a good thing, correct?
It is a good thing.
So that Honorable Kajuju must reconsider her decision to expel us.
Yes, this provision actually, for contempt of court, is actually sort of generic throughout jurisdictions. It's there, and we also have it in our jurisdiction.
Good.
But it just comes to the conditions of service. When it comes to, they will give all the powers of the courts and say, oh, you'll be disciplined like a judge and everything.
Yeah.
But just when it comes to the conditions of service, it becomes
that's
a
different
problem.
Exactly. So, hence, you can be suspended willy-nilly. Okay, and just to complete that point, Section 11 of our Act, then that's where it is criminalized clearly. So it says, any person who contravenes the provisions of Section 9 of this Act or interferes with the functioning of the Office of the Public Protector in terms of Section 1814 of the Constitution shall be guilty of an offence. Now, this is a very serious provision. It means any person, including this parliament, if it didn't have immunity in terms of Section 58 of the Constitution, any person who interferes with the what you and I have called functional autonomy of the public, of the Office of the Public Protector, and interferes with how it hires people and all that, is guilty of a criminal offense and liable to a fine of not exceeding 40,000 or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 12 months or to both such fine and such imprisonment. Now, assuming there was no such thing as parliamentary privilege, would this be a sufficient protection from any institution in this country, whatever it is? It could be the milk board or whatever, interfering with the functional autonomy of the public protector.
It does provide protection. It does provide protection.
Yeah. Okay. So if we remove parliamentary privilege, we could just send the police to round off, starting with the chairperson. maybe we'll challenge him next time. We must have this meeting outside there in the street. No, sorry, on a serious note. Okay, but all I'm saying is that, well, whether in practice it works or not, at least you can be sure that our legislature, or the people who did this act in 1994, tried their best, at least at a structural level, to give teeth to the protections provided in Section 181(4), for example, the Constitution. Okay. Thank you. All right. So, Chairperson, the next sitting, can you have it in Kukulate? Next to the police station. Right. Now, you were still explaining to us broadly the difference between, you just wanted to clarify that point, the difference between the so-called classical and hybrid model.
Yes, in the classical ombudsman system, which is the system which exists, I'll give the example of Zambia, for example, and Malawi, Angola, Mozambique. These ombudsman institutions investigate solely maladministration, and they are all accountable to Parliament, and they operate, because of that, they operate relatively without any conflict of interest. But where you have a hybrid ombudsman institution, so the hybrid ombudsman institution could be an executive ombudsman, or it could be a parliamentary ombudsman, but it will have multiple mandates. So it will have the mandate to investigate maladministration, and or corruption, human rights, and like for example with the Israeli office, the office of the ombudsman is also the auditor general. So they've merged both functions. So with the issue of the multiple mandates, I think the only drawback perhaps maybe that the ombudsman function may suffer, it may be relegated, and you find that the other mandates of, for example, human rights or corruption, they become more superior. They are given more attention by the ombudsman office. And secondly, when there is an issue of a mandate like corruption, the perception by the government or members of the public or the opposition may be that this is a law enforcement institution, and they want to have the office operate like a law enforcement institution.
And I now want to come to the topic that, as I said in the morning, for me defines really your evidence. In your evidence, and when I summarize towards the end, there are maybe four or five broad themes, including these issues of protection, these issues of independence, and so on that we've covered. But if one were to reduce your thesis or departure point, it would be found in, I think it's paragraphs 23 and 24 of your statement, where you deal with the I'm just making sure that I'm correct. No, it's not. It's 23 and 24 of another document, but it's the last paragraph of your statement. Sorry, the last paragraph of your statement, which after you've referred to the case of economic freedom fighters, which we'll deal with tomorrow. But your central thesis is at paragraph 40, where you say, however, it is evident that issuing binding decisions make the ombudsman amenable to review of his decisions by courts of law. The courts also seem to feel threatened by the judicial powers of the ombudsman, and there's always a temptation by any one of the three arms of government to trim down the powers of the ombudsman, as evidenced by matters in Zambia and South Africa. Once the powers of the ombudsman seem to overlap or to be shared by any one of the three branches, inevitably the institution of the ombudsman may have to be reined in by the arm which feels challenged. Am I correct that ultimately that you are a clear advocate or proponent of the recommendations model and an opponent of the binding decision model for the reasons you've explained earlier?
Yes.
All right. Now let's go to that topic. In our situation in particular, as I say, as a young democracy, what apart from the cases which we'll deal with tomorrow, but just generally speaking, what would be your warnings, lessons, cautions, whatever you call it, against the binding decision model, which you are against?
First of all, the institution of the ombudsman, as I have stated previously, investigates the executive. And obviously, the office who investigate very sensitive cases. And it's very, very important that during the course of investigation, the ombudsman has the complete cooperation of the respondent institutions, being the executive, emanating from the executive. So when the decisions of an ombudsman are binding, when the ombudsman is carrying out the investigations, the institutions of the executive feel threatened. And the ombudsman may not get as much cooperation, even though you have provisions like the ones that we have seen where there is contempt of court for a party not to cooperate with the office of the ombudsman. So secondly, where binding decisions are issued, there is usually a temptation to try to influence the ombudsman to issue decisions in a particular way.
Mm.
There could be such a temptation, and it defeats the whole issue of having this office given the status of a judge, the high status of a judge, having the institution created by a constitution, having a clause for the independence of the institution, all these other measures which have been put in place to protect the office of the ombudsman, it defeats the whole process once you just give an ombudsman binding powers. And thirdly, you open up the office to constant litigation, because respondent institutions will not be happy. They want to challenge the decisions of the ombudsman, and they will be dragging the ombudsman constantly to court over the decisions that the ombudsman has issued. And fourthly, it just becomes expensive for the ombudsman. Now it has to create a budget for litigation. So the best protection that you can give an ombudsman office is to ensure that the recommendation, the reports of the ombudsman have the effect of recommendations and not the effect of binding decisions. It just ensures that the whole process follows through to the end without any interference, no ripples in the system.
Good. All right. Of course, yeah, as like everything in life, it's give and take. So what you're saying is that what we give in respect of the binding nature of the powers, which at face value seems like a good thing because, you know, it can't be ignored, we lose independence, vulnerability to harassment, budgetary constraints, and again, to come back to my refrain, it's possible, at least I won't put it higher than that, that had we had in South Africa the recommendations model, we wouldn't be sitting here, because it's a what we call a ripple effect. We're here because there were judgments against the public protector. There were judgments because members of the executive in the main challenged the decisions. They challenged the decisions because they are binding. And that chain reaction is clear, well, for anyone who has eyes, that what has brought us here is in a way the regime that we've had since 2016 up to now. Because all the things you have mentioned here have happened here. The budget has shot up. This particular public protector has probably been in court for all her term. And now here we are. She's being harassed or given the ultimate death sentence equivalent of her office by simply being here. So let me put it this way. It seems to me then the only way to get out of that trap would be a constitutional amendment. And I'll be impeached in this country for suggesting such a thing. But on a serious note, is there any other way that we can come out of it except by amending the constitution?
This binding power for the remedial action reports of the public protector in this country, I think it was brought about by way of a court judgment. I don't know if the courts would be willing to review their own judgment, you know, possibly, because I think the constitution does not say that the remedial powers of the public protector are binding. I don't know. I'm not an expert on South African constitutional law, but that is a way that it could happen. There is a a case in Zambia where I know the Supreme Court reversed its own decision, and in a particular case where they declared one judgment of theirs bad law, and reversed their own decision.
Yes. Okay. Well, speaking
apart from constitutional amendment,
yes,
as you
no,
said,
I
apart
think
from
yeah, the chances of the charge, the court reversing its own judgment, first of all, I'm not very good. But even if they were, then one would have to wait for a case which may never come.
Yeah.
In the meantime, we'll be in this kind of situation. But, okay, that's a debate you and I can have offline. The point of the matter is that the Nkandla judgment was, at least from the point of view of the Constitutional Court, an interpretation of our current constitution. And therefore, I was in that case, it related to particularly these sections 181, 1814, section 96, and so on, and even the Public Protector Act. And the sum total of what we argued there was that that interpretation means that we should have the binding model, and the court agreed. But so that's why I'm saying, short of a constitutional amendment, we should then specifically say it prefers the recommendations regime. I can't see us coming out of that here. By the way, in your country, you are in the same position. But just to be clear, so that you're not criticizing us for that just because you come from a better situation. Isn't it true that the 2016 amendment in Zambia also introduced the binding regime?
Yes, it did.
And but unlike us, you don't have a constitutional court case, or do you, that affirms that position? It's spelled out in the constitution.
It's spelled out in the constitution, and we do have a judgment which stated that the binding decision-making power of the public protector is not absolute, and it can be subjected to judicial review by the High Court.
Yes, that's the court. Okay, that's the Zambian court case that said that that distinguished between court judgments and remedial action of the public protector.
Yes.
And it relied on one of our cases,
yes,
from the SCA, Home Affairs versus Public Protector, correct?
Was it not a Nkandla judgment?
No. Well, my... yeah.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
It was the judgment of Judge Plaskett in the Home Affairs case. But we'll get to that tomorrow. Let's just say... it relies on a South African case,
yes,
to do that. So once again, we led you into the opposite direction. But in that, was your office a party to that litigation?
Yes.
And were you on the successful side or the unsuccessful side? In other words, what was your argument? Was it that the powers should be binding, or that there should be a recommendation?
Our argument was that because the powers were binding, we could not be subjected to judicial review.
Okay.
And then the court disagreed and said, no, actually, insofar as it concerns the court, your powers are not absolute. And you can be subjected to judicial review.
Oh.
And they actually quoted a South African authority. And
yes.
What was so, for us, what was so perplexing was that the binding powers of the reports of the public protector in Zambia are actually contained in the constitution very clearly. And whereas the judgment they were relying on here in South Africa was the one that actually imbued the Office of the Public Protector South Africa with binding powers.
Yes.
So it
yes.
was...
Okay. And with respect to your Constitutional Court, actually the judgment in Home Affairs was a judgment about whether or not the Office of the Public Protector is an organ of state and is subject to PAJA or legality review. So I think they missed the point, but it happens to the best of us. Yeah. The case that we are talking about, just to be sure, is called Indeni Petroleum Refinery. That is in 2019, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Okay, then yes, you did rely on, in fact, I got this, you must have just forgotten because I'm getting this information from one of your speeches. the case that they relied on was Minister of Home Affairs versus Public Protector, which is a 2018 case here of the SCA, not even the Constitutional Court. Okay. All right. So at least we are in the same boat as Zambia when it comes to this conundrum of binding versus recommendation remedial action, correct?
Yes.
And you've said that the classical model or the correct model or the better model is the recommendation regime. Do you know, just top off the top of your head, international, and maybe Honorable Kajuju would also have a perspective on this, whether most countries, are we and Zambia in the minority, or are we in the majority, or is it 50-50?
We are in the minority.
We're in the minority, okay. Thank God. All right. Okay. And needless to say, then our regime, our common regime, is more prone to reprisals, all the things we spoke about, the threats and what have you, than the other model, correct?
Yes.
Right. Now, Are you okay? Are you fine? Are you not tired? Do you want a 5 minute break? We've been going on the whole day.
I'm fine, thank you.
Are you still fine? Okay. I asked you during the break, you said you are still able to push. Okay, please indicate if you need a comfort break or anything like that. I'll see what I can do. I'll ask the chair. All right. Right. Now, I'm going to the United Nations now. If you go to page one of your statement, and it's also paragraph one, triple. Thank you very much. Okay, so show me the big page. 218, yes. All right. Okay, we'll paraphrase this because it's late in the day now. It would be safe to say, I call this just for my own shorthand when I was making my notes, I called it the December movement. It looks like...
Sorry, Mr. Mpofu, we don't take issue with the section either.
Pardon?
We don't take issue with this paragraph.
Oh, thank you. That's good to know. I call it the December movement because it looks like everything happened in December. But that's just the UNGA system is like that. When they do something in a particular month, then they'll always be meeting in that month. Yeah. But on a more serious note, we have a series of instruments from the United Nations, which have culminated in what you had earlier said, the embracement, if there's such a word, of the Venice Principle. Starting in December 1993, that's your paragraph two, there was the adoption by the UNGA, the United Nations General Assembly, of the Paris Principles, correct?
Correct.
And thereafter, over the years, there were further adoptions. I think there's one in 2010, 21st December 2010. And I just want to highlight there that, again, the key words there were independence and autonomy, correct?
Correct.
And then in 2014, December 18, 2014, there was another resolution of the United Nations. And again, at paragraph three, it talks about strengthening of independent and autonomous ombudsman institutions. The same two words that have found their way into the OR Tambo principles, correct?
Correct.
Then we have the UN Resolution 68171 that gave the same principles that we had in the IOI document, that ombudsman institutions should not face any form of reprisal or intimidation, including political pressure, physical intimidation, harassment of unjustifiable budgetary limitations. Just to wrap up something that my learned friend had raised about the alleged leading. It's bundle D, page 3906. Let's just get that out of the way quickly.
You're not clear? Just come again, Andrew and Wolf.
Oh, bundle D, 3906. Okay, maybe I should just describe it, yeah. It's the witness statement of Ms. Mohaladi. I remember when I was responding to Advocate Bauer, I wasn't sure if she was one of the people who made, but she's one of many. Yes, it's paragraph 104. Page 3906. Yes. This is what she had to say. I'm just addressing the chair, just for the record. So the eradication of the backlogs and preventing the accumulation of further backlogs is therefore a priority for the PP, as it should be for any responsible executive authority. I can attest that it is also a priority for the executive managers and the COO. The main reason for the backlog is the lack of sufficient human resource capacity in investigation. This is a fact that is well known, as well, to obviously just to some. This is a fact that is well known, as the current and previous PPs have consistently been raising this issue and requesting additional funding from National Treasury and Parliament. The issue is also reflected in the various annual reports of the PPSA, as I indicated here. That's just to get that issue out of the way, Chair. And that's why I was putting it as if it's something that, as the statement says, well known. Yeah. All right. We were at paragraph 4. So I was saying that we're highlighting those the measures should be implemented against political pressure, physical intimidation, harassment, and all that. Right. Then the important one, or rather, they're all important, but the most recent, I think, is Resolution 72. Stroke 186 of 16th of adopted on the 16th December 2020. And you say in your statement, this important resolution secured worldwide recognition of the Ombudsman Institution and established the Venice Principle as the global standard for Ombudsman Institutions. So that's why we spent so much time on the Venice Principles and we went through all the various articles. This is now, from 2020, to the Bible, as it were, for these institutions. That has now been accepted globally at the level of the UN.
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you. And to which South Africa is a signatory and, quite frankly, is bound by. Correct?
Correct.
And if South Africa is bound by the Venice Principles, and we have shown so many areas in which this process flouts those Venice Principles, what would be your message to the chairperson or the committee about the dangers of going that way? Assume I'm right, I might be wrong, that this process flouts most of those provisions.
I think the best that I can say is that we all, as African countries, we are on a journey towards attaining the perfect, you know, status of constitutional democracy and a respect for human rights. It's a journey. So when you're on a journey, sometimes you can go forward and you find that you have taken a wrong turn, and you can come back and say, no, maybe this is the right route that I have to take. All of us are on the same journey. So it's nice to reflect. It's nice to come together like this and exchange experiences and see what it is that we can do for ourselves as Africans. And maybe my biggest plea is to you as South Africa to say, you know, lead us. We are, you know, we are watching you. You are a proper constitutional democracy, and we want to follow by example. You already have the seat of ombudsmanship in this country. Sometimes you can try to lose a little so that you can gain a lot more for the larger majority. For the greater majority. As I was coming here, I was thinking about it, and I don't know if I'm making a mistake in referring to this. You know, I thought about, I'm old enough to remember what was happening in Zambia, Tanzania, were fighting for, you know, the independence of other countries like Mozambique, Angola, Namibia, South Africa. We sacrificed, you know, we were, you know, not getting even small things like Coca-Cola, you know, Fanta. If you got a Coca-Cola or a Fanta, it was a treat because we were refusing to trade with South Africa, the apartheid regime. So, you know, for Rhodesia, then under Ian Smith, he would come freely into our country and just bomb us, you know. So the frontline states decided to sacrifice something in order to ensure for the greater good. So I can just appeal to you. Yes, sometimes it's hard to say, no, let us go back a little bit and look at what we can do in this situation. But you are fighting a battle for the whole of Africa, for the ombudsmanship of Africa. So what message are we sending out there, you know, all of us, you know? So it's very, very important. So I think that's what I can say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm sure the chair has heard you and those that will listen to you and him. But maybe to put it more crudely, if this kind of thing that's happening here, that has been happening here for the past 7 months, continues, and you say the world is watching, Africa is watching, you've been watching, maybe closer than others, because you've been here, Honorable Katrich's office has been here, she's been here, and if it continues unabated, let's assume that those words of yours are not listened to and we just forge ahead to the bitter end, whatever that is. What do you think that impact of that would be to somebody out there, some spirited person whose wish in life was to be the public protector, and they've been gearing themselves to apply for the next round? If what is happening here continues, would you advise your child to apply for such a job?
What I can say is we're all at different levels of development. Some African countries have strong democracies. Some have weak democracies. And we have to help them to move along. So let's help each other. Let's raise up the institution of the Ombudsman in Africa as a beacon. This is the only institution where the poorest of the poor can come and they can summon even the president of a country to say, because me, Caroline Sokoni, I've got a complaint that I've not been given my passport. I want you, public protector, to call the president to come and answer to this. It's the only institution which the poor man can call upon. And we shouldn't allow those poor people to lose heart and to lose faith in this institution that has been set up for them. So I can just appeal to just say, you know, it's a cry from all of us. And this, that's the reason why I'm here, you know, from AOMA, to say, let us save this institution. Let us not allow it to die. Let us not allow people to start distrusting this institution. And just by applying the international principles that have been discussed at this session, I think it's very, very, very possible that this whole situation can actually be saved.
Yes. And I'd like your comment to this. You've commented about the use or the wisdom or lack thereof of what I call transplanting judicial pronouncements into Parliament on the notion that they are binding to courts as if they are also binding to Parliament. But that's a debate for another day. You've also commented about the breach of organizational or functional autonomy, which is associated with the fact that this particular process has been dominated by, as I told you, 15 out of 18 witnesses who are just employees and coming to air their gripes here and their personal grudges and all that. But what do you have to say about the fact that in all of this, whatever the cost may be, there is a cost. I think we're all clear on that. A bigger than money, I'm talking about a cost in a broader sense. But actually, what the worst thing that the public protector seemingly has done to deserve all this is that she wanted people to give services to the poor, chase the backlogs, make sure that the deadlines are met, produce clean audits so that governance is at its best. For the first time in that institution, 3 clean audits in a row. For the first time, even her worst enemies agree that the backlogs are at an all-time low since this institution was ever put into office or into place. In other words, nobody's saying she came there and she harassed people sexually or she was drunk or what, you know. Obviously, I'm just saying there are things that would require the intervention of Parliament, which are grotesque and unacceptable to all of us in society. But should a public protector, ombudsman, whatever you call it, be literally impeached for improving governance and delivery?
My answer to that would be no, and I also have a selfish reason for that. And my selfish reason is that, you know, I've been ombudsman for 18, this is my 19th year. We have come a long way in ombudsmanship in Africa. And the reason why I actually agreed to come here is because I felt that I can't allow us to go backwards to when I was appointed in 2004. You know, let us strengthen this institution. Let us encourage other African countries to set up this institution.
Okay. Thank you. On that note, Ms. Sokoni and Advocate Booth, we will pause there.
Thanks, sir.
And adjourn our meeting. We will meet again tomorrow morning at 10.
Chief, just this matter of housekeeping. Can I ascertain from Advocate Booth for how long he's still going to be?
I'm going to attempt to finish around about tea time. Not much longer than that, but I'll try to yes. I know that's why there's one section, if you might have noticed, that I'm going to do mainly, which is the court cases, and the rest will just be cleaning up. So it shouldn't take that long. I'm mindful of the fact that not only there'll be questions from the evidence leaders and also from the members. So I will not abuse the indulgence of
the chair. Thank you, Mr. Thank you, colleagues. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.
Recording stopped.